The Wonderland Murders by Hollywood and Crime contains depictions of violence and is not suitable for everyone. Please be advised.
Examining the head of victim one, I see definite pattern marks in the blood coming across the nose to the left ear and under the chin up onto the neck. There appears to be pattern marks on the nightshirt near the left buttocks, coming up onto the coffee table. There is a large area of blood. Examining the mug on the coffee table, there are blood spatters around the mug.
Eddie Nash had come a long way since running a hot dog stand on Hollywood Boulevard. The former Adel Gharib Nasrallah was born to an Orthodox Christian family in Ramallah, just outside Jerusalem, in 1929. He would later claim that by age 19, he already owned several hotels and that he'd lost everything after the creation of the State of Israel in 1948. He would say that his brother-in-law had been shot dead by Israeli troops, several of the bullets almost hitting him as well. In the early 1950s, he left Palestine for the United States with $10 in his pocket. He was about to start a new life as the freshly minted and newly Americanized Eddie Nash. By his 20s, he had settled in Los Angeles, finding occasional work as an actor or stuntman. An excellent horseman, he appeared in an episode of The Cisco Kid as a character named Nash. But acting jobs were hard to come by. As his hopes of film stardom faded, he kept pursuing the American dream. He worked long hours cooking and waiting tables at Beef's Chuck, the hot dog stand he opened and operated. By the 1970s, he'd parlayed his tiny establishment into a small empire worth over $30 million. He owned dozens of nightclubs and restaurants around L.A., including PJ's, Sold Out, and the Kit Kat. He prided himself on catering to a varied clientele. There was a black club featuring Harlem jazz, a Santa Monica Boulevard spot blaring cutting-edge rock and roll. The Seven Seas boasted a tropical theme and served specialty drinks. There were teen clubs and strip clubs and gay clubs, belly dancers, and a Polynesian review. In the Hollywood nightclub scene of the 1970s, Eddie Nash had become a player. By any measure, it was an American success story. From Wondery, this is The Wonderland Murders by Hollywood and Crime. I'm Tracy Patton with our writer-director, Larry Brand. If you're joining us for the first time, we recommend you go back and listen to the previous episodes in order. We'll be waiting for you. Today's episode, The Snitch. Here's my co-host, Larry Brand.
Before the release of Johnny Wadd, John Holmes' entry into the X-rated universe is less than meteoric. Adult films of the late 60s, usually 8mm shorts known as loops, are as thin on plot as they are on production value. The male lead would enter the life of a bored housewife or lonely woman, sometimes two women, on the thinnest of pretexts. After a few banalities, they would proceed to have sex. Prior to the unlikely success of Deep Throat, sex loops were largely the province of frat parties and peep shows. Actors would be paid $35 for the one-day shoots before the shifting casts and crews would move on to the next production. By the time John walks into Bob Chin's office, the audience for adult films has grown more discerning. Chin is determined to do his part to meet the growing demand, creating a franchise around the adventures of a hard-drinking private detective. Johnny Wadd would make John C. Holmes a household name among porn aficionados. From the beginning, John threw himself into the role, relishing the opportunity to create a character with some dimension. He learns his lines quickly, delivers them with ease. Bob Chin is impressed with his unselfconscious performance. Afterward, he would hang out on the set, happy to engage with crew and cast alike. Always eager to please, he'd often pitch in to strike the set. "You know you're wrapped for the day," Bob would tell him. and John would flash that goofy grin that let everyone know he was just part of the team. John's claim of expertise in every field extends to special effects makeup. When he hears Bob is making an erotic slasher movie, John says he can handle the blood and gore. Chin is less than confident. The day of the shoot, John shows up on set and excitedly brings Bob over to his car. When he opens the trunk, the stench almost knocks the director backwards. The trunk is filled with supermarket packages of cow's liver, brains, and tripe. Most of it is already rotting in the California heat. "Jesus, John, did you get that out of a dumpster?" Bob gasps. John insists he paid for it, though the crumpled receipts are barely legible. But he does a surprisingly good job, applying the effects, covering the actor in viscera, and dousing him with a gallon of stage blood. Bob Chin has to admit, whatever his flaws, John is a tireless worker. When he's not starring, he's happy to be a bit player or even extra. When not in front of the camera, he finds work behind it as a production assistant or AD. He always seems happiest when he's on set. At home, John downplays his role in adult entertainment. Sharon knows he appears in films, but convinces herself they're of the soft core variety. John lies that most of the time he works on the crew, gripping and lighting sets. Sharon tries her best to separate it from their life together, talking about it as little as possible. The shared pretense works, however imperfectly, until one day she finds a promotional photograph from one of his films. It's an explicit shot of John having sex with another woman, and there is nothing softcore about it. She confronts him, and John does what he always does, acting like a juvenile delinquent busted by his mother. "It's just a job to me," he mutters. "Yeah," she nods, recalling their first conversation on the subject. "Just tools to a carpenter, right?" He looks down, refusing to meet her eye. And then Sharon does what she always does, forgives him, and lets him stay. But something has changed. The photo makes concrete what she's long pushed out of her mind. It makes it real. She tells him they'll stay together, living as husband and wife. She'll cook his food and do his laundry. She'll be his mother, his sister, his confessor. They can share the same bed, go to sleep together and wake up together, but she'll never have anything to do with him physically again. And so begins a semblance of married life. They have dinner when John isn't working, talk about the day's news. On weekends, they go shopping at the mall, check out flea markets. They bring home odd items John refurbishes and puts to use around the house. But when John disappears for days at a time, Sharon won't ask where he's been. When he comes home in the middle of the night and slips under the covers beside her, she'll pretend to be asleep. The next morning, they might have breakfast together as she prepares to go to work. He'll tend to chores around the complex before heading off for the day's shoot. Sharon's insulation from that part of his life is complete.
Barbara Richardson was 22 years old when she was bludgeoned to death in the Wonderland Avenue house. Though the autopsy revealed signs of intravenous drug use, she had no criminal record. It appeared her main connection to the murder house was through her boyfriend, David Lind. Lind was known to police as a career criminal who'd served time for offenses ranging from drug possession to burglary and assault. He was also a member of the Wonderland gang. Word on the street was he had recently arrived in L.A. to help out on a planned robbery, bringing Barbara along with him. At the time he was interviewed by police, Lind was aware there was a female survivor of the massacre. He was holding out hope it was Barbara. When they told him it was Susan Lanius and not his girlfriend, Lind lost control. He jumped up, knocked his chair backward. The detectives watched as he pulled out a Quaalude and popped it in his mouth. Then the biker started taking pills out of his pockets, throwing them in his mouth or onto the table in a small pile. Lang and Sousa looked at each other. They had little interest in the illegal substances displayed before them. They waited until Lind could compose himself. As experienced police officers, they knew better than to take anything at face value from a lifelong criminal like Lind. But his grief at the death of his girlfriend seemed genuine. The fact that he was willing to implicate himself in another major crime, one that had occurred days before the murders, added credibility to what he told them. The detectives believed that his connection to the house and its illicit activities could be valuable to their investigation. David Lind had a story to tell, and they were there to hear it.
Bob Chin stops for a moment and stares out at the water. The filmmaker in him tries to record the multiple shades of blue that morph into each other before merging with the horizon. Then he closes his eyes and listens to the waves hitting the jagged lava rock. The smells are as rich as the colors, salty sea air combining with a dozen flowers he can't name. Yes, this was a fine decision, beyond the legal considerations. No one among the cast or crew is complaining either about being in Hawaii. It'll be the fourth of the Johnny Wadd movies, Tropic of Passion, and Bob Chin has decided on a location shoot. The plot has the sex-crazed private eye helping a beautiful young heiress being blackmailed with a sex tape. The young woman flies into Hawaii, where they begin an inevitable affair of their own. But the choice of location has little to do with the title or plot, nor is it the natural beauty of the islands. Bob Chin has more practical considerations. Recently, he and his fellow adult film directors have been under increasing pressure from LA Vice cops to shut down their operations. More and more shoots are being busted. So Bob comes up with a ruse. He tells the star of the franchise he's going on vacation to Hawaii. His cameraman will be coming along to shoot some B-roll of the local flora. If John just happens to find himself in Hawaii at the same time, well, maybe they can get together and film something. This way, no one can accuse the director of transporting his actor across state lines for immoral purposes. Though the constitutional issues continue to evolve throughout the 70s, production of a pornographic film is still a felony in LA. Hollywood relishes its status as film capital of the world, but has little interest in being seen as the porn capital as well. So, authorities use whatever laws they can to curb the industry. Watching an adult movie might be legal, but making one is punishable by up to 3 years in prison. And having sex for money, even if it's for appearing in a movie, is still a crime. Shoots are regularly busted, and filmmakers take precautions to hide their locations. They meet at restaurant parking lots, give last-minute instructions on where filming will take place. They caravan over in separate cars. Labs processing the films are under threat as well, and often inform on pornographers rather than risk jail time. They allow cops to look at the footage and gather information on the principals. If police receive a timely enough tip, they can stake out the meeting point. They take down the license plates of the participants, then follow them to the location and observe as the crew and actors enter to begin filming. By relocating the Tropic of Passion to Hawaii, Bob Chin places production safely out of reach of the LA authorities. What Bob can't know is that he's brought an informant along with him.
From early on, club owner Eddie Nash had a complicated relationship with the law. Like any good entrepreneur, he knew who the power brokers were and how to play them. He contributed to political campaigns on all sides and gave generously to police charitable organizations. Eddie understood the game. When he came to the attention of the authorities, as he frequently did, nothing ever seemed to stick. He'd been indicted for torching one of his buildings for the insurance money, but charges were dropped. His establishments were the sites of frequent drug busts, but Eddie remained untouched. Rumors about his darker side flourished in the LA of the 1970s. There were tales of people who'd screwed him over on a deal and were never heard from again, lurid conjectures about bodies buried in the desert. A whole area was said to be devoted to those who'd tried to take advantage of the hard-nosed emigre. How much of it was true and how much due to drug-fueled speculation was hard to say. But the story served Eddie's interests well. Word had gotten round. You don't fuck with Eddie Nash.
On the sets of his films, John is a reliable performer. Most of his female co-stars like working with him, finding him gentle and solicitous of their needs. He never flaunts his leading man status with the crew, often pitching in to help them set up and wrap. Producers are happy with the revenue his films generate and don't complain as his salary rises commensurate with his stature. In a world where females are almost always paid more than men, John is an exception. He's becoming a star. His one quirk, is a constant desire for novelty. He rarely works with the same actress twice, preferring an ever-shifting population new to the X-rated scene. One night, he spots two young women in a bar who seem to be looking back at him. He saunters over, taking it for granted they recognize him. They're little more than kids, 18, 19, from Calabasas. He likes their look, likes even more that they haven't done porn before. He puffs himself up, comfortable with his new celebrity. He tells them about an upcoming shoot he's in. He's got enough pull to get them a job if they're interested. Beats hanging out in Calabasas. They're giggly but into it. He fronts them a few dollars, knowing he'll be reimbursed by production. He leaves the place, pleased with himself for discovering new talent. A few weeks later, there's a knock at the door of the Glendale home shared by John and Sharon Holmes. John lets LAPD detectives Tom Blake and Joe Gandley in, affably trying to engage them in small talk. He brags about his health regimen, proudly showing off the shelf of vitamins in the kitchen cabinet. Then the officers get down to why they're there. Sharon watches expressionlessly as they inform her husband they have a warrant for his arrest from the Ventura County DA's office. John understands enough of the law to know that porn actors are rarely charged. It might be a gray area, but for the most part, the cops are more interested in the film's backers. More often than not, they're tied to organized crime. For a moment, he wonders if it's his high profile as a performer that's got them interested. But the detectives tell him he isn't being arrested for appearing in films. Remember those two young women he recruited for that shoot a while back? In front of Sharon, John pretends not to know what they're talking about. Cops explain that because he paid the two Calabasas girls, John is being charged with the far more serious offenses of pimping and pandering. He's taken to the Ventura County Sheriff's Office and booked. John is convicted of the felony charges and faces up to 3 years in prison. As he sits listening to the sentence, John's swagger and childlike charm fall away, the career that's finally giving him money, and more importantly, the recognition he's always desired, now might destroy his life. But then he has a talk with Vice Cop Tom Blake, who tells him there might be a way he can avoid hard time. How about 3 years on probation instead of in jail? After all, the Vice Cop tells him, we know you're just an actor in these things, right? Only trying to earn a living? By now, John's listening closely. Look, we're really after the producers and financiers, the fat cats who get rich off guys like you. Blake gives John a long look and then grins. Don't you play a detective in those movies? How would you like to be Dick Tracy in real life? John takes it all in. He assesses his options and decides he has only one. And so begins a long relationship between John Holmes and LAPD Vice Officer Tom Blake. Though his friends and co-workers have to contact John through his messaging service, Blake will have his home number. When the phone in their Glendale cottage rings and Sharon hears Big Tom's voice on the line, she knows to pass the receiver to her husband without questions. John accepts the assignment with some flair, as if merging his on-screen persona with his new role as snitch. He enjoys his late-night meals with Blake, happily passing information on about the times and locations of shoots, providing names of those involved. It's unclear whether his participation represents a childish joy in playing cops and robbers, or a devious plan to subvert the careers of his competition while he remains immune from prosecution. Johnny Wadd has become a real undercover agent.
Eddie Nash made a mistake common to his profession. He'd begun tasting his own product. By the mid-1970s, drugs were a regular feature at many of Eddie's night spots. During one of the frequent busts of the Starwood Rock Club, a box containing several thousand counterfeit Quaaludes was confiscated. They'd been marked for distribution at box office. But Eddie's intoxicant of choice eventually became cocaine, and he was soon on his way to becoming a full-blown addict, consuming $1 million worth of the narcotic a year. By the time he'd switched from snorting to freebasing, he was missing part of his sinus cavity. He would go on to lose a lung, have a steel plate placed in his head. His hands would be scarred by burn marks. As his addiction grew, he became more reclusive, rarely leaving the house, even to attend to the business of his many clubs. He would be up for days at a time, sometimes more than a week, wandering his Studio City estate in his silk robe or bikini underwear. Increasingly paranoid about his competitors, he hired a live-in bodyguard. At 300 pounds, karate expert Gregory Dials slept with a sawed-off shotgun in his bed. He also had a fondness for steel pipes. To protect his assets, Eddie had a safe built into the floor of his bedroom. Two-way mirrors were installed throughout the house so guests could be watched to see if they could be trusted among piles of cash and mountains of dope. Eddie Nash, millionaire businessman, drug kingpin, addict, liked to be ready for anything.
When, in the summer of 1976, Sharon notices John spending a lot of time with two teenage sisters staying in a nearby cottage, she finds an innocent interpretation. The girls have been all but abandoned by their father, who always seems to be off somewhere. John finds the sisters' odd jobs around the complex, gardening or cleaning up the units. But it doesn't escape her notice that John seems to be paying particular attention to the older of the two, who looks to be about 15. When the girl enrolls in the local high school, John walks the few yards to her door every morning to make sure she's ready for class. He's just trying to help a kid in need, John assures his wife. Sharon feels sorry for the girl, sensing they're from a broken home. As she has so many times, she gives John the benefit of the doubt. One day, though, a neighbor comes over and tells her John has been paying too much attention to the older of the two sisters. Sharon hides her reaction, half-heartedly defending her husband until the woman leaves. But she's had enough. When John comes home, she corners him in the back room he uses as his office. "What is going on with that girl?" she demands. John feigns innocence, widening his eyes and hunching his shoulders. "You know what I mean. The one across the courtyard, Dawn. What is she, 15? John takes a deep breath. "Let's not do this, Sharon. I'm helping the poor kid out." "What you do off by yourself is your business," she says. "God damn it, Sharon, nothing is going on." He starts to turn away, and suddenly she flies into a rage, startling herself as much as him. Before he can get another word out, she flings a heavy bookcase over onto him, splitting his head open. John sits there stunned, blinking as blood dribbles into his eyes. Sharon grabs her purse and calmly walks out of the house. She drives over to Eagle Rock Plaza, wanders among the department stores and boutiques. John gathers himself and gets in his car. It's hours before he finds her at the Glendale Galleria. He angles over and Sharon assesses the damage. He's got a black eye from the bookcase. A thin crust of dried blood lines his scalp. "Looks like you'll make it," she says, emotionless. He nods bleakly. "Where have you been?" "None of your business," she pins him with her stare. John nods again, suitably contrite. But Sharon is ready to come home.
Chris Cox watched as his after-hours club burned. Even on the other side of the street, he could feel the heat from the flames. Fire teams pumped water furiously onto the blackening shell of the place he'd run for less than a year. He couldn't say the fire was a surprise. The bomb threats had begun shortly after he had turned down Eddie Nash's offer to buy him out. Chris understood the risk he was taking. Everyone who was part of the L.A. nightclub scene of the 70s knew about Eddie. When rival club owners referred to Nash as the Godfather, they were only half-joking. You had to kiss his ring if you wanted to get anything done. People who turned down his offers seemed to quickly have a change of heart. People who crossed him seemed to simply disappear. The two men had only a passing acquaintance when Chris opened up his gay night spot across the street from one of Eddie's places. Relations between the two men had been cordial enough, at least on the surface. When Chris turned down Nash's offer to buy him out, the businessman took the rejection with a smile and a shrug. Well, maybe at some future date. Shortly afterwards, the bomb threats had begun, and it became hard for Chris to maintain a steady business. Now he stood watching as the flames sputtered and died under the weight of torrents of water from the fire hoses. The street was flooded, the air stank of smoke and charred wood, and nothing was left of Chris's club but a blackened skeleton. Chris Cox rethought his decision to turn down Eddie Nash.
In 1975, John's brother David moves to Glendale with his wife Karen and her 4-year-old son from a previous marriage. John sets the family up in a back unit of the complex he and Sharon manage, and the two brothers start hanging out regularly. It isn't long before David's supply of marijuana runs out, and he asks John if he can score for him. A lifelong teetotaler, John has always prided himself on his abstinence. Even on adult film sets, with drugs readily available, the self-styled health nut refuses to partake. David says the weed relaxes his nerves, and John agrees to help him. It isn't hard to find marijuana in 1970s L.A. Pretty soon, the brothers are smoking together. Since Sharon refuses to allow illicit drugs in her house, the back cottage becomes an easy getaway for John. When David asks if they might expand their repertoire of mind-altering substances, John secures some magic mushrooms. Eventually, pills are added to the list. Reds, Black Beauties, Quaaludes. By 1976, John is rarely without his weed. He's also begun carrying a bottle of J&B scotch in the brown Samsonite briefcase he now takes with him everywhere. If Sharon notices his reddened eyes or dilated pupils, she doesn't say anything. John's life is his own. As a nurse, she can spot the signs of increasing drug use, but chooses the path of least confrontation. She also ignores the attention he continues to pay Dawn, the 15-year-old girl across the courtyard. Truth is, Sharon has a soft spot for the girl and her younger sister, who seem adrift in the world. When John takes the girls on day trips to the nearby woods or even on overnight camping jaunts, she assigns a benign intent. John is filling in for an absent parent. Increasingly, Sharon chooses what to see and what not to see. It's always been a strategy of necessity when dealing with her husband. They've become unfamiliar occupants of the same small house as she chooses to let go of him, one bit at a time.
On the night he watched his club burn to the ground, Chris Cox could not have imagined he'd become friends with Eddie Nash. Though nothing was proven, nothing was ever proven against Eddie, Chris was pretty certain the rival club owner had been behind the arson. But Eddie had an easy charm about him, liked to think of himself as the good and generous host, especially in victory. He would invite Chris over to the Starwood, sweetening his entreaties with generous doses of drugs. No longer competitors, they fell into something like a mentor-student relationship. Eddie offered to guide Chris through the peculiarities of LA's rough-and-tumble nightclub world. The two found they also had a love of cocaine in common, in particular, freebase. Chris found himself hanging out more and more at Eddie's Studio City estate, frequenting his 24-hour parties. He watched a shifting population of young women and seedy characters from the narcotics trade come and go. The lucky ones got an audience with the Godfather in his bedroom. Eddie would saunter around the place like a Middle Eastern potentate wrapped in his silk robe. He developed a penchant for whips and a fascination with playing Russian roulette. He required an ever-changing vanguard of young girls to keep him entertained. Even in a land of excess, Eddie Nash stood out. Though not shy about indulging, Chris began to worry about his friend. He'd never seen anyone consume as much cocaine as Eddie. He watched Eddie's hands shake as they held the pipe, palms and fingers permanently scarred from gripping the hot glass. More and more, Nash would lock himself in his room for hours or days, getting high and watching pornography. He had already lost his wife and kids, a part of his sinus cavity, and one lung. He was down to an emaciated 140 pounds. He even stopped attending as many businesses, preferring to remain in his house for days on end with curtains drawn. Checks would be brought out to the property by underlings. Eddie would have to be corralled and made to focus enough to sign them. Eddie Nash might still be a player in LA's nightlife, but to those who knew him, he seemed to be disappearing into himself.
Bob Chin is starting to worry about the man he made a star. John Holmes is changing, and everyone knows it. Once affable and ingratiating, ready to flash that goofy grin, he's become increasingly moody, dismissive of the industry that gave him a name and a living. When they started working together, Bob would marvel at how many scenes John could perform in a day, then have energy to hang out with the crew. He would volunteer to help load and transport equipment. Sometimes on location, he insisted on cooking for everyone, always eager to please. In Hawaii, he learned that cameraman Alan Patrick was going on a date with a Japanese girl he'd met. John insisted on cleaning Alan's condo, laying out flowers and wine for the romantic interlude. In the morning, he prepared a sumptuous breakfast for the couple. Bob enjoyed his relationship with John. After a day's shoot, they might go out for a meal at Musso and Frank's on Hollywood Boulevard, and John would tell stories that Bob knew were at least half bullshit. But over the last few months, John has been increasingly erratic and moody, taking advantage of his leading man status. He shows up late, making demands. His salary has gone up considerably from the $75 he earned on Johnny Wad, but it's never enough, and always a source of contention between him and Bob Chin. If John isn't satisfied with some aspect of a shoot, he shuts it down. Actresses who once described him as gentle and caring now find him rude and insensitive. Often he disappears into the bathroom for hours at a time, leaving the crew standing around uselessly. And when he finally emerges, blue eyes wild and buzzed, it's nearly impossible to get him to focus. He shrugs off his frequent bathroom visits as just needing some time by himself. The people around him know what's going on. It's not an uncommon pattern in Hollywood in the 1970s. The energetic, self-styled health nut, who once proudly displayed his shelf of vitamins, has moved on from the weed and pills he shared with his brother. The one-time teetotaler is now rarely seen without his brown Samsonite briefcase with its bottle of J&B. But it isn't until John tries powder cocaine for the first time that he discovers his true chemical love. It's become a staple of adult movie sets, though directors like Bob Chin frown on its use until the shoot wraps for the day. Bob asks John to leave his stash at home, and John agrees. But as the hours drag on and the star known for his reliability finds it increasingly difficult to perform, Bob realizes he's been lied to again. John Holmes has found something he loves more than sex.
From what Tom Lang and Robert Souza were hearing, it all seemed to have started over a set of antique guns. After learning his girlfriend Barbara Richardson had been among the dead at Wonderland, David Lynn had been forthcoming with the detectives. He told them about the burglary of the weapons from a businessman earlier that year. There was a flintlock rifle, a Colt revolving shotgun, and a pair of 1856 Colt cap-and-ball pistols with engraved cylinders. The guns had become the prized possessions of gang leader Ron Lanius. He would proudly display them at parties, mock firing them at guests. He might not have considered parting with them, had his heroin supply not dried up in early summer of 81, but as usual, his addiction took precedence. Strapped for cash, he offered the weapons as payment for enough dope to get him straight for a while. Through a friend, he'd made contact with a major dealer living less than 5 minutes away. The intermediary took the guns over and returned a while later with $1,000 worth of heroin. Ron quickly used up the heroin, but fumed about the transaction. Those guns had to be worth at least 25 grand. Eddie Nash took a look at the weapons and nodded. Yes, they were beautiful. They felt good in his hands and would look good mounted on his wall. He'd heard about the Wonderland Gang, though the name seemed to credit the group of junkies and misfits with too much organizational skill. Eddie was strictly big time, and these guys were, by all accounts, lowlifes. They always seemed in need of heroin, more for personal use than dealing, and who was Eddie to turn down business? They might even be able to work together if the gang could concentrate more on moving product than on the burglaries and strong-arm robberies they were known for. Eddie hefted the guns. Yes, he would keep them, but he was in no hurry to pay what they were worth in either drugs or cash. For one thing, they'd be impossible to fence. Their unique design made them instantly recognizable. It would be like trying to sell a known painting. So Eddie sent a message back through their mutual friend. He'd keep the guns as collateral against the $1,000 in heroin he was fronting them. As soon as the Wonderland gang came up with the cash, they'd get the guns back. Ron Lanius didn't take it well. More than the paltry amount of dope, he resented Nash's high-handedness. Eddie's stature in the L.A. underground of drug trafficking meant nothing to Lanius. He shot up the dope, and when the high faded, his anger flared. He determined to get those guns back as soon as he had the $1,000 he owed Eddie. But every dollar the Wonderland gang raised through their sundry crimes was spent on more heroin. Lanius would often return to his anger at Eddie Nash, stomping around the Wonderland house, caught between his need for a fix and his desire to get back his beloved antique weapons. Above all was a mounting rage at being treated like a nobody. Yes, he'd heard that no one fucked with Eddie Nash. He'd heard about the bodies in the desert. But Ron Lanius was not someone you fucked with either. And if you looked hard enough, you might find a few bodies connected to him as well. The more time passed, the more he would tell himself and anyone willing to listen. You don't fuck with Ron Lanius. Next time on The Wonderland Murders, The Inside Man. As John Holmes' drug use begins creating problems on the set, film jobs are harder to come by. Increasingly desperate, he's begun stealing from his wife, his friends, his co-workers. But just when Holmes is about to hit rock bottom, he meets drug kingpin Eddie Nash, and things start to look up, at least for a while. Subscribe to Hollywood and Crime on Apple Podcasts, NPR One, Wondery.com, or wherever you're listening right now. To find a link to subscribe to The Wonderland Murders by Hollywood and Crime, and for more information on the episode notes, simply tap or swipe over the cover art. You'll also see some offers from our sponsors. Please support our show by supporting them. If you like what you've heard, we'd love you to give us a 5-star rating and review us. And be sure to tell your friends and fans of true crime. We're counting on you to help us spread the word. If you want to hear more of the Wonderland Murder series right away, you can get all 6 episodes ad-free by subscribing now to Wondery Plus. Go to wondery.com/plus. That's P-L-U-S. You'll also get exclusive access to other Wondery shows, in addition to extra content and perks. The Wonderland Murders is written and directed by Larry Brand and produced by Rebecca Reynolds, Tracy Patton, and Jim Carpenter for Hollywood and Crime. Producers wish to thank Jennifer Sugar and Jill C. Nelson, authors of John Holmes, A Life Measured in Inches. Bob Chin, author of The Other Side of Paradise, the uncensored memoirs of Bob Chin. And Julia St. Vincent, director of Exhausted, John C. Holmes, The Real Story. Special thanks to retired LAPD detective Tom Lang, co-author with Robert Souza of Malice in Wonderland. The Wonderland Murders was recorded at the Invisible Studios, West Hollywood, California. Executive producers Marshall Louie and Hernan Lopez for Wondery.